The light of the early morning touched the tall towers of Imrir and made them scintillate. Each tower was of a different hue. There were a thousand soft colors. There were rose pinks and pollen yellows. There were purples and pale greens, mauves and browns and oranges, hazy blues, whites and powdery golds, all lovely in the sunlight. Two riders left the dreaming city behind them and rode away from the walls, over the green turf towards a pine forest, where among the shadowy trunks a little of the night seemed to remain. Squirrels were stirring and foxes crept homeward. Birds were singing and forest flowers opened their petals and filled the air with delicate scent. A few insects wandered sluggishly aloft. The contrast between life in the nearby city and this lazy rusticity was very great, and seemed to mirror some of the contrasts existing in the mind of at least one of the riders, who now dismounted and led his horse walking knee-deep through a mass of blue flowers. The other rider, a girl, brought her own horse to a halt but did not dismount. Instead, she leaned casually on her high Meldimidean pommel and smiled at the man, her lover. "Elric, would you stop so near to Imrir?" He smiled back at her over his shoulder. "For the moment. Our flight was hasty. I would collect my thoughts before we ride on." "How did you sleep last night?" "Well enough, Cymril, although I must have dreamed without knowing it, for there were little intimations in my head when I awoke. But then the meeting with Irkun was not pleasant."
"Do you think he plots to use sorcery against you?"
Elric shrugged. "I would know if he brought a large sorcery against me. And he knows my power. I doubt if he would dare employ wizardry."
"He has reason to believe you might not use your power. He has worried at your personality for so long. Is there not a danger he will begin to worry at your skills, testing your sorcery as he has tested your patience?"
Elric frowned. "Yes, I suppose there is that danger. But not yet, I should have thought."
"He will not be happy until you are destroyed, Elric."
"Oh, or is destroyed himself, Cymril." Elric stooped and picked up one of the flowers. He smiled. "Your brother is inclined to absolutes, is he not? How the weak hate weakness." Cymril took his meaning. She dismounted and came towards him. Her thin gown matched almost perfectly the color of the flowers through which she moved. He handed her the flower and she accepted it, touching its petals with her perfect lips.
"And how the strong hate strength, my love. Irkun is my kin, and yet I give you this advice. Use your strength against him."
"I could not slay him. I have not the right." Elric's face fell into familiar, brooding lines.
"You could exile him."
"Is not exile the same as death to a Melnibonean?
You yourself have talked of traveling in the lands of the young kingdoms."
Elric laughed somewhat bitterly. "But perhaps I am not a true Melnibonean. Irkun has said as much, and others echo his thoughts."
"He hates you because you are contemplative. Your father was contemplative, and no one denied that he was a fitting emperor."
"My father chose not to put the results of his contemplation into his personal actions. He ruled as an emperor should. Irkun, I must admit, would also rule as an emperor should. He too has the opportunity to make Melnibone great again. If he were emperor, he would embark on a campaign of conquest to restore our trade to its former volume, to extend our power across the earth. And that is what the majority of our folk would wish. Is it my right to deny that wish?"
"It is your right to do what you think, for you are the emperor. All who are loyal to you think as I do."
"Perhaps their loyalty is misguided. Perhaps Irkun is right, and I will betray that loyalty, bring down the Dragon Isle.
His moody crimson eyes looked directly into hers. Perhaps I should have died as I left my mother's womb. Then Irkun would have become emperor. Has fate been thwarted? Fate is never thwarted. What has happened because fate willed it thus, if indeed there is such a thing as fate, and if men's actions are not merely response to other men's actions. Elric drew a deep breath and offered her an expression tinged with irony. Your logic leads close to heresy, Simril. If we are to believe the traditions of Melnibone, perhaps it would be better if you forgot your friendship with me. She laughed. You begin to sound like my brother. Are you testing my love for you, my lord? He began to remount his horse. No, Simril, but I would advise you to test your love yourself, for I sense there is tragedy implicit in our love. As she swung herself back into her saddle, she smiled and shook her head. You see doom in all things. Can you not accept the good gifts granted you? They are few enough, my lord. Aye, I'll agree with that. They turned in their saddles, hearing hoofbeats behind them. Some distance away, they saw a company of yellow-clad horsemen riding about in confusion. It was their guard, which they had left behind, wishing to ride alone. Come, through the woods and over yonder hill, and they'll never find us. They spurred their steeds through the sun-speared wood and up the steep sides of the hill beyond, racing down the other side and away across a plain, where noidal bushes grew, their lush, poison fruit glimmering a purplish blue, a night color which even the light of day could not disperse. There were many such peculiar berries and herbs on Melnibone, and it was to some of them that Elric owed his life. Others were used for sorcerous potions and had been sown generations before by Elric's ancestors. Now few Melnibonaeans left Imrir even to collect these harvests. Only slaves visited the greater part of the island, seeking the roots and shrubs which made men dream monstrous and magnificent dreams. For it was in their dreams that the nobles of Melnibone found most of their pleasure. They had ever been a moody, inward-looking race, and it was for this quality that Imrir had come to be named the Dreaming City. There, even the meanest slaves chewed berries to bring them oblivion, and thus were easily controlled, for they came to depend on their dreams. Only Elric himself refused such drugs, perhaps because he required so many others simply to ensure his remaining alive. The yellow-clad guards were lost behind them, and once across the plain where the noidal bushes grew, they slowed their flight and came at length to cliffs and then the sea. The sea shone brightly and languidly washed the white beaches below the cliffs. Seabirds wheeled in the clear sky, and their cries were distant, serving only to emphasize the sense of peace which both Elric and Simril now had. In silence, the lovers guided their horses down steep paths to the shore, and there they tethered the steeds and began to walk across the sand, their hair his white, hers jet black, waving in the wind which blew from the east. They found a great dry cave which caught the sounds the sea made and replied in a whispering echo. They removed their silken garments and made love, tenderly, in the shadows of the cave. They lay in each other's arms as the day warmed and the wind dropped. Then they went to bathe in the waters, filling the empty sky with their laughter. When they were dry and were dressing themselves, they noticed a darkening of the horizon, and Elric said, "We shall be wet again before we return to Imrir. No matter how fast we ride, the storm will catch us." "Perhaps we should remain in the cave until it is past," she suggested, coming close and holding her soft body against him. "No, I must return soon, for there are potions in Imrir I must take if my body is to retain its strength. An hour or two longer, and I shall begin to weaken. You have seen me weak before, Simril.
She stroked his face, and her eyes were sympathetic.
I've seen you weak before, Elric. Come, let's find the horses.
By the time they reached the horses, the sky was gray overhead, and full of boiling blackness not far away in the east. They heard the grumble of thunder and the crash of lightning. The sea was threshing as if infected by the sky's hysteria. The horses snorted and pawed at the sand, anxious to return. Even as Elric and Simril climbed into their saddles, large spots of rain began to fall on their heads and spread over their cloaks. Then suddenly they were riding at full tilt back to Imrir while the lightning flashed around them and the thunder roared like a furious giant, like some great old lord of chaos attempting to break through unbidden into the realm of Earth. Simril glanced at Elric's pale face illuminated for a moment by a flash of skyfire, and she felt a chill come upon her then, and the chill had nothing to do with the wind or the rain, for it seemed to her that in that second that the gentle scholar she loved had been transformed by the elements into a hell-driven demon, into a monster with barely a semblance of humanity. His crimson eyes had flared from the whiteness of his skull like the very flames of the higher hell. His hair had been whipped upward so that it had become the crest of a sinister war helm, and by a trick of the stormlight, his mouth had seemed twisted in a mixture of rage and agony. And suddenly, Simril knew, she knew profoundly, that their morning's ride was the last moment of peace the two of them would ever experience again. The storm was a sign from the gods themselves, a warning of storms to come. She looked again at her lover. Elric was laughing. He had turned his face upward so that the warm rain fell upon it, so that the water splashed into his open mouth. The laughter was the easy, unsophisticated laughter of a happy child. Simril tried to laugh back, but then she had to turn her face away so that he should not see it, for Simril had begun to weep. She was weeping still when Imrir came in sight, a black and grotesque silhouette against a line of brightness which was the as yet untainted western horizon. The men in yellow armor saw Elric and Simril as the two approached the smallest of the eastern gates. "They have found us at last," smiled Elric through the rain. "But somewhat belatedly, eh, Simril?" Simril, still embattled with her sense of doom, merely nodded and tried to smile in reply. Elric took this as an expression of disappointment, nothing more, and called to his guards, "Oh, men! Soon we shall all be dry again." But the captain of the guard rode up urgently, crying, "My lord emperor is needed at Monshenyuk Tower, where spies are held." "Spies?"
"Aye, my lord."
The man's face was pale. Water cascaded from his helm and darkened his thin cloak. His horse was hard to control and kept sidestepping through pools of water, which had gathered wherever the road was in disrepair.
"Caught in the maze this morning, southern barbarians by their checkered dress. We are holding them until the Emperor himself can question them."
Elric waved his hand.
"Then lead on, Captain. Let's see the brave fools who dare Melniboné's sea maze."
The Tower of Monshenyuk had been named for the wizard architect who had designed the sea maze millennia before. The maze was the only means of reaching the great harbor of Imrir, and its secrets had been carefully guarded, for it was their greatest protection against sudden attack. The maze was complicated, and pilots had to be specially trained to steer ships through it. Before the maze had been built, the harbor had been a kind of inland lagoon, fed by the sea, which swept in through a system of natural caverns in the towering cliff which rose between lagoon and ocean. There were 5 separate routes through the sea maze, and any individual pilot knew but one. In the outer wall of the cliff, there were 5 entrances. Here, young kingdom ships waited until a pilot came aboard. Then one of the gates to one of the entrances would be lifted. All aboard the ship would be blindfolded and sent below, save for the oarmaster and the steersman, who would also be masked in heavy steel helms so that they could see nothing, do nothing, but obey the complicated instructions of the pilot. And if a young kingdom ship should fail to obey any of those instructions and should crush itself against the rock walls, well, Melnibone did not mourn for it, and any survivors from the crew would be taken as slaves. All who sought to trade with the dreaming city understood the risks, but scores of merchants came every month to dare the dangers of the maze and trade their own poor goods for the splendid riches of Melnibone. The tower of Monshanyuk stood overlooking the harbor and the massive mole which jutted out into the middle of the lagoon. It was a sea-green tower and was squat compared with most of those in Imrir, though still a beautiful and tapering construction with wide windows so that the whole of the harbor could be seen from it. From Monshanyuk Tower, most of the business of the harbor was done, and in its lower cellars were kept any prisoners who had broken any of the myriad rules governing the function of the harbor. Leaving Simril to return to the palace with a guard, Elric entered the tower, riding through the great archway at the base, scattering not a few merchants who were waiting for permission to begin their bartering, for the whole of the ground floor was full of sailors, merchants, and Melnibonean officials engaged in the business of trade, though it was not here that the actual wares were displayed. The great echoing babble of a thousand voices engaged in a thousand separate aspects of bargaining slowly stilled as Elric and his guard rode arrogantly through to another dark arch at the far end of the hall. This arch opened onto a ramp which sloped and curved down into the bowels of the tower. Down this ramp clattered the horsemen, passing slaves, servants, and officials who stepped hastily aside, bowing low as they recognized the Emperor. Great brands illuminated the tunnel, guttering and smoking, and casting distorted shadows onto the smooth obsidian walls. A chill was in the air now, and a dampness, for water washed about the outer walls beyond the quays of Imrir. And still the Emperor rode on, and still the ramp struck lower through the glassy rock. And then a wave of heat rose to meet them, and shifting light could be seen ahead, and they passed into a chamber that was full of smoke and the scent of fear. From the low ceiling hung chains, and from eight of the chains swinging by their feet hung four people. Their clothes had been torn from them, but their bodies were clothed in blood from tiny wounds, precise but severe, made by the artist who stood, scalpel in hand, surveying his handiwork. The artist was tall and very thin, almost like a skeleton in his stained white garments. His lips were thin, his eyes were slits, his fingers were thin. His hair was thin, and the scalpel he held was thin too, almost invisible, save when it flashed in the light from the fire, which erupted from a pit on the far side of the cavern. The artist was named Dr. Jest, and the art he practiced was a performing art rather than a creative one, though he could argue otherwise with some conviction. The art of drawing secrets from those who kept them. Dr. Jest was the chief interrogator of Melnibone. He turned sinuously as Elric entered, the scalpel held between the thin thumb and the thin forefinger of his right hand. He stood poised and expectant, almost like a dancer, and then bowed from the waist. "My sweet Emperor!" His voice was thin. It rushed from his thin throat as if bent on escape, and one was inclined to wonder if one had heard the words at all, so quickly had they come and gone. "Doctor, are these the Southlanders caught this morning?"
"Indeed they are, my lord."
Another sinuous bow.
"For your pleasure."
Coldly, Elric inspected the prisoners. He felt no sympathy for them. They were spies. Their actions had led them to this pass. They had known what would happen to them if caught. But one of them was a boy, and another a woman, it appeared. Though they writhed so in their chains, it was difficult to tell at first. It seemed a shame. Then the woman snapped what remained of her teeth at him and hissed,
"Demon!"
And Elric stepped back, saying, Have they informed you of what they were doing in our maze, Doctor?
They still tantalize me with hints. They have a fine sense of drama. I appreciate that. They are here, I would say, to map a route through the maze, which a force of raiders might then follow. But they have, so far, withheld the details. That is the game. We all understand how it must be played.
And when will they tell you, Dr. Jest?
Oh, very soon, my lord.
It would be best to know if we are to expect attackers. The sooner we know, the less time we shall lose dealing with the attack when it comes. Do you not agree, Doctor?
I do, my lord.
Very well. Elric was irritated by this break in his day. It had spoiled the pleasure of the ride. It had brought him face to face with his duties too quickly. Dr. Jest returned to his charges and, reaching out with his free hand, expertly seized the genitals of one of the male prisoners. The scalpel flashed. There was a groan. Dr. Jest tossed something onto the fire. Elric sat in the chair prepared for him. He was bored rather than disgusted by the rituals attendant upon the gathering of information, and the discordant screams, the clash of chains, the thin whisperings of Dr. Jest all served to ruin the feeling of well-being he had retained even as he'd reached the chamber. But it was one of his kingly duties to attend such rituals, and attend this one he must, until the information was presented to him, and he could congratulate his chief interrogator, and issue orders as to the means of dealing with any attack. And even when that was over, he must confer with admirals and with generals, probably through the rest of the night, choosing between arguments, deciding on the deposition of men and ships. With a poorly disguised yawn, he leaned back and watched as Dr. Jest ran fingers and scalpel, tongue, tongs, and pincers over the bodies. He was soon thinking of other matters, philosophical problems, which he had still failed to resolve. It was not that Elric was inhumane. It was that he was, still, a Melnibonean. He had been used to such sights since childhood. He could not have saved the prisoners, even if he had desired, without going against every tradition of the Dragon Isle. And, in this case, it was a simple matter of a threat being met by the best methods available. He'd become used to shutting off those feelings which conflicted with his duties as Emperor. If there had been any point in freeing the four who danced now at Dr. Jest's pleasure, he would have freed them. But there was no point, and the four would have been astonished if they had received any other treatment than this. Where moral decisions were concerned, Elric was, by and large, practical. He would make his decision in the context of what action he could take. In this case, he could take no action. Such a reaction had become second nature to him. His desire was not to reform Melnibone, but to reform himself. Not to initiate action, but to know the best way of responding to the actions of others. Here, the decision was easy to make. A spy was an aggressor. One defended oneself against aggressors in the best possible way. The methods employed by Dr. Jest were the best methods.
My lord?
Absently, Elric looked up.
We have the information now, my lord.
Dr. Jest's thin voice whispered across the chamber. Two sets of chains were now empty, and slaves were gathering things up from the floor and flinging them on the fire. The two remaining shapeless lumps reminded Elric of meat, carefully prepared by a chef. One of the lumps still quivered a little, but the other was still. Dr. Jess slid his instruments into a thin case he carried in a pouch at his belt. His white garments were almost completely covered in stains.
It seems there have been other spies before these. These came merely to confirm the route. If they do not return in time, the barbarians will still sail.
But surely they will know that we expect them.
Probably not, my lord. Rumors have been spread amongst the young kingdom merchants and sailors that four spies were seen in the maze and were speared, slain, whilst trying to escape.
I see. Then our best plan will be to lay a trap for the raiders.
Aye, my lord.
You know the route they have chosen?
Aye, my lord.
Elric turned to one of his guards.
Have messages sent to all our generals and admirals. What's the hour?
The hour of sunset is just past, my liege.
Tell them to assemble before the Ruby Throne at 2 hours past sunset. Wearily, Elric rose. You have done well, as usual, Dr. Jest. The thin artist bowed low, seeming to fold himself in two. A thin and somewhat unctuous sigh was his reply. Yyrkoon was the first to arrive, all clad in martial finery, accompanied by two massive guards, each holding one of the prince's ornate war banners. My emperor! Yyrkoon's shout was proud and disdainful. Would you let me command the warriors? It will relieve you of that care when, doubtless, you have many other concerns with which to occupy your time. Elric replied impatiently. You are most thoughtful, Prince Yyrkoon, but fear not for me. I shall command the armies and the navies of Melnibone, for that is the duty of the Emperor. Yyrkoon glowered and stepped to one side as Divim Tavar, Lord of the Dragon Caves, entered. He had no guard whatsoever with him, and it seemed he had dressed hastily. He carried his helmet under his arm. My Emperor, I bring news of the dragons. I thank you, Divim Tavar, but wait until all my commanders are assembled and impart that news to them, too. Divim Tavar bowed and went to stand on the opposite side of the hall to that on which Prince Yyrkoon stood. Gradually the warriors arrived until a score of great captains waited at the foot of the steps which led to the Ruby Throne where Elric sat. Elric himself still wore the clothes in which he had gone riding that morning. He had not had time to change, and had, until a little while before, been consulting maps of the maze, maps which only he could read, and which, at normal times, were hidden by magical means from any who might attempt to find them. Southlanders would steal Imrir's wealth and slay us all, Elric began. They believe they have found a way through our sea maze. A fleet of 100 warships sails on Melnibone even now. Tomorrow it will wait below the horizon until dusk. Then it will sail to the maze and enter. By midnight it expects to reach the harbor and to have taken the Dreaming City before dawn. Is that possible, I wonder? No! Many spoke the single word. No, Elric smiled. But how shall we best enjoy this little war they offer us? Yyrkoon, as ever, was the first to shout. Let us go meet them now, with dragons and with battle barges. Let us pursue them to their own land and take their war to them. Let us attack their nations and burn their cities. Let us conquer them and thus ensure our own security. Divim Tavar spoke up again. No dragons, he said. What? Yyrkoon whirled. What? No dragons, Prince. They will not be awakened. The dragons sleep in their caverns, exhausted by their last engagement on your behalf. Mine! You had us use them in our conflict with the Vilmirian pirates. I told you that I would prefer to save them for a larger engagement, but you flew them against the pirates and you burned their little boats, and now the dragons sleep. Yyrkoon glowered. He looked up at Elric. I did not expect... Elric raised his hand. We need not use our dragons until such a time as we really need them. This attack from the Southlander fleet is nothing. But we will conserve our strength if we bide our time. Let them think we are unready. Let them enter the maze. Once the whole 100 are through, we close in, blocking off all routes in or out of the maze. Trapped, they will be crushed by us. Yyrkoon looked pettishly at his feet, evidently wishing he could think of some flaw in the plan. Tall old Admiral Makum Kulim in his sea-green armor stepped forward and bowed.